Hey everyone, JP Tuesday here. There were some audio issues with the recording of this episode that I did not notice until I actually sat down to edit it. Kiki's entire half of this conversation has an echo on it. I tried to reduce it, and all I did was make it sound worse. So I'm leaving the original audio, as is, to preserve the conversation. I apologize for this, and I hope you can still enjoy today's episode. Thank you. I'm JP Tuesday.
And I'm Kiki Cannon. We've been Disney fans our entire lives. And now, as childless adults, we're undertaking a journey through the media that shaped our lives.
Trying to find out if what made them special is still there.
We are Rewatching the Magic.
Hey, Kiki.
Hi, Tuesday. So I've got an interesting thing to tell you about something nice that one of our fans slash friends did for me. I got a gift because of this show.
Really?
An early Christmas gift from somebody who was listening to the show and thought of me. They found in their house some vintage Little Mermaid merchandise from 1989.
Really?
And they thought, after having just recently listened to our Little Mermaid episode, our first episode, she thought that it would be a gift that I would like because I talked about how important Little Mermaid was to me. So she came over and she gave me some very nice vintage merch from her childhood and our childhood that actually is original 1989 Little Mermaid merch from the Disney store or whatever at the time.
What kind of merch was it?
It is a pin, a little plastic pin that has Ariel in it. That's very cool, and I'm a pin collector with my own little collection and stuff. And she knows that. And some adorable Valentine cards that were printed for little kids back in the day to give out during class, and she still had some, and they're adorable, and one has Sebastian on it and stuff, so it's very cute. And Laura, if you're listening, thank you for the gift, and also thank you for, I guess, being our first fan gift, I guess, because of the show. So that was so neat and such a nice early Christmas treat, so thanks.
Happy holiday season's greetings to you.
Yeah, happy holidays.
And to you, our dear listener, because today we are talking about probably one of the most popular holiday movies in the Disney catalog. That would be Tim Burton's The Nightmare Before Christmas.
Woo-hoo.
Yes, if we're going to talk Christmas movie, you know, snow is falling. It's all bright and colorful. What better time to talk about a movie about a talking skeleton?
Exactly. Well, it is in my house. I don't know how the rest of you live, but...
Yeah. So, is there anything you want to talk about the movie before we just get into it? Did you see this in the theater or anything?
I do believe I did actually see this one in the theater. This would have been fully... Once I got the permission to go see movies in theaters, you could not pull me out of the theater after that point. So, from after Beauty and the Beast, I think I saw everything in a theater until I was like 25. So...
And again, you know, this is Tim Burton. This is right after he did, you know, Beetlejuice and Edward Scissorhands and two Batman movies. So he was already a name at this point.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, even though I had not seen the Beetlejuice movie when I was a kid,
I did see that in the theater.
Beetlejuice was a cartoon show when we were kids, and I knew it from that. So I had like toys of Lydia and stuff from the cartoon show and everything. But everything I knew about Beetlejuice came from that cartoon, which was kind of funny. I didn't see the movie until later, but. That was kind of an interesting thing, you know, with, like, people talking about, you know, like, oh, you like that movie too. And I'm like, they made a movie out of that cartoon? That's awesome.
So, let's get a little quick run through of Tim Burton, because we like to do a bit the back story of a lot of these movies. So Burton always wanted to make movies. So that's pretty much his own thing. He's always been a fan of movies, always wanted to make movies, been making movies since he was a kid. Just go through the run through. Went to Cal Arts, got noticed by Disney, got hired by Disney as an animator. So he was already doing animation as it is. He ended up working on Fox and the Hound, Tron, Black Cauldron, that era, you know, which was, you know, kind of the era we were kind of right when we were, like, infants.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He did stop motion movies. He did a little movie called Vincent. I don't know if you've ever seen that.
I have not. I have seen most of his oeuvre, as you would, and I have a very special place in my heart for stop motion animation. But that one is just one that... Is it on Disney Plus? Because I desperately want to see it.
I don't think it is.
It was very hard to find when I was little. It was like one of those things that I heard of, but it was very difficult to find in the video stores around here.
Yeah, he did a live-action short called Frank and Weenie, which is on Disney Plus.
Yeah, Frank and Weenie I had seen. That one strangely was in the video store in my town.
And of course he would revisit Frank and Weenie about 20 years later and make a full animated movie out of that.
Which oddly I haven't seen.
So the thing about Frank and Weenie is Disney fired him for this movie, for that little short, because it was too scary for kids and he was using Disney resources for it.
But the interesting thing is that they would revisit the same excuse for Nightmare Before Christmas.
I'm getting to that soon. And, you know, like I said, after getting fired by Disney, who would end up hiring him but Paul Reubens?
Yeah.
He was looking for a director for a little movie, you guys may have heard of it, Pee-wee's Big Adventure.
And if there was ever a meshing of styles that was kind of entirely appropriate, it was probably Paul Reubens in his Pee-wee prime.
Yeah, before
turning to Tim Burton. I cannot imagine. And I mean, we all know how it turned out. But, you know, those two aesthetics are so perfectly together.
And so much of what people associate with the character of P.B. Herman is really Tim Burton's direction in that movie.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, a lot of it is Paul Reubens' own writing of his own character, but the visual style is just Tim Burton.
I think that a lot of people who were younger, because we were younger at the time, and it took me a while. You know, Pee-wee wasn't a big part of my childhood. I kind of came to him later. Mm-hmm. But when I would hear kids talk about it, you know, like, oh, we watched Pee-wee and whatever, I never understood kind of what a dark edge that whole thing had to it until I got a little bit older and I was like, I wonder what all those kids were talking about. I started looking back at the show and I was like,
that scary clown animatronic, the entire scene in the joke shop, Large Marge.
Just the movie. I'm talking about like the TV show. There was something about the brand of humor of the entire character of Pee-wee.
Yeah.
That as kids, I don't think we quite realized that's where Paul Reubens' brain was going with it.
Yeah.
But I think adults picked up on that, which I think is why every adult I knew was creeped the hell out by Pee-wee when we were kids. But the kids absolutely loved it, you know. And like everybody I knew was huge into the show, and I, you know, I wasn't. But that's why I think that Tim Burton was, of course, who else are you going to get? Because I think him and Paul Reubens are kind of weirdly broken in the same kind of way as far as their art.
Yeah, and Burton and Reubens would end up working together, ironically, on this film.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, they've kind of kept in touch over the years, as it were.
Like I said, after Pee-wee, he does Beetlejuice, Edward Scissorhands, two Batman movies. And so by the time 1990 rolls around, Burton's is in demand. And of course, Disney wants him back. So, you know, Burton, he revisits this idea, this poem he wrote while he was working at Disney called The Nightmare Before Christmas, which Disney actually printed that poem as a book. So you can actually get the children's book of The Nightmare Before Christmas, which is Burton's original poem with his original artwork.
You know, from what I've read about it and kind of looking back for this and just stuff over the years, I do question how much of going back to Disney was more like, was Burton's kind of like, wow, it sure would be nice to go back and work for Disney now that they want me again and I'm the big cheese, versus Disney owned The Nightmare Before Christmas and he really wanted to make that movie.
Column A, column B.
Yeah, I'm sure it was. You know, I mean, if
you fired me for this style, now I'm going to make a movie with your money in this style.
Yeah, and you know who wouldn't want to be the person who comes back to Disney begging you to come back now that you're the new hotness.
Yeah,
you know. Like, you fired me for this exact thing, like you said, you know, it's like, and now I've become known for that style.
Yep.
So, you know.
So, not so much now, because he's doing a lot of remakes. I mean, Charlie and Chocolate Factory, Alice in Wonderland, Dumbo.
But they all have, even Dumbo has that, like, you know, maybe not like, you know, the striped snake from Beetlejuice or whatever, but it still has that kind of weird, dark tinge to it that leaves you slightly unsettled that maybe this isn't for you.
Yeah, so Burton doesn't really direct this movie. He did write it. He does produce it. He did do the artwork for it. Again, considering this is like 1990, 1991, he was already doing Edward Scissorhands and Batman Returns at the time, so his schedule's a bit full.
But I don't think that was really the reason he didn't direct this. Because as much as I am a huge fan of Tim Burton and his work, to be very frank. I mean, you know, I grew up as the weird little morbid goth kid. I'm gonna like Tim Burton. But this is not just any normal movie. This is a stop motion movie. And that requires an extremely specific skill set that nobody can really do. You don't really find a lot of general directors, even animation directors, who just go like, well, my last project was 2D animation, now let's do stop motion. Entirely different world. Stop motion directing is its very own particular beast, and you really only find people doing it if that's their niche. And Henry Selick is the Mac Daddy of stop motion niche at that point, and still at this point. I mean, he still is the best. And he took over from Ray Harryhausen, who was One of the original Mac Daddies of the style. Ray Harryhausen really took what had been kind of done with the style in the 70s, and by the 70s he is the god of stop motion. I was fortunate enough to get to meet him and see him before he passed, and his work was just, you can see it all over this film if you know what you're looking at. If you know anything about stop motion, there is so much in this that the way the skeletons move and stuff, the way Jack moves, comes from those Harryhausen skeletons that you'd see in like Jason and the Argonauts.
Did he also direct Corpse Bride, or was that someone else? There's a lot of similarities between here, this, and Corpse Bride.
Selick. I know he did James and the Giant Peach. I know he did Coraline. I know he did some of the other ones, I can't remember if he did. No, it doesn't. Doesn't seem like he did. But like I said, just like Harryhausen was kind of the guy who set the standard. By that point, Selleck was the guy who set the standard. You know, so it's gonna be. You know, there's going to be some similarities. I've been fortunate enough to see some of the animated puppets from Coraline that they used. They're housed in Atlanta in the Museum of Puppetry Arts. That's really neat. As well as some from The Corpse Bride, I believe. So Selleck was really the natural choice, is kind of what I'm saying. So even though the aesthetic is completely Tim Burton, the actual, like, on the ground, day to day stuff is very definitely Selleck's style.
So let's move on. Let's talk about Danny Elfman.
Danny Elfman, Danny Elfman, music sounds like Danny Elfman. It just sounds like Danny Elfman. Sorry.
Yeah, I mean, let's be honest. I mean, even. Of course, Danny Elfman, Tim Burton, they've been working together since Pee-wee's Big Adventure. Burton really hired Elfman because he was a really big Oingo Boingo fan.
Who isn't a big Oingo Boingo fan, though? Come on.
I mean, honestly.
If you're not an Oingo Boingo fan, what have you been doing with your life?
You can take Dead Man's Party, put clips of Nightmare on it, and it'll fit.
Yeah, I mean, we are very definitely 80s kids, and if you don't like you some weird science, you just gotta put underwear on your head and dance around to that one.
And take it straight up Barbie doll to life.
Yep.
We're old.
we are disintegrating before your ears.
So yeah, Danny Elfman. Not only does he do the music for this movie, he does do the singing voice for Jack.
And honestly, it's the singing voice for Jack that's really the impressive thing to me. When I was doing the rewatch, I was like, man, him and Chris Sarandon really nailed that character together.
And I've heard Chris Sarandon sing. He sounds a lot like Danny Elfman singing.
Yeah. I do wonder why they chose to split it up, because it's not like Chris Sarandon can't sing.
No. The stories that I've heard was that Tim Burton heard the scratch lyrics, the scratch vocals, and was like, yeah, we're going to keep you and we're going to have you do this.
Yeah, and I mean, that's fair.
That's what I've heard. I don't know if that's the actual truth, or it could be that Chris didn't think he could properly do the song justice, which, again, I've heard him sing the songs in The Nightmare Before Christmas. Yes, he can.
I also wonder about how they arrived at the voice, the two of them. Did Danny Elfman do some scratch vocals of this is kind of what I think you're probably going to go with? Did they already cast Chris Sarandon and have some scratch vocals from him? I don't know. It's one of those things that I've never quite known and I've always kind of wanted to.
The story that I've heard was that Sarandon was hired because he sounded like Elfman.
Nice.
So it was like, I guess Burton's idea was always to have Elfman do the voice, but I guess Elfman didn't want to do the dialogue, or he was just that good at doing the scratch vocals.
I don't know, but they nailed it. I mean, it was years before I knew that wasn't the same guy.
Mm-hmm.
So, bravo to them.
So yeah, and of course Danny Elfman still working with Tim Burton to this day. All but three movies of Tim Burton's that Elfman has done music for, one of them being Sweeney Todd, because that was already a musical.
Yeah. Sorry. Sondheim beat you to that one. As far as film partnerships and music goes, Tim Burton, Danny Elfman is right up there with Spielberg and John Williams.
Yeah.
I mean, there's like, until one of them, unfortunately, knock on wood, please God, no, passes, you're not going to see a Spielberg film without a Williams soundtrack, and I think that it's kind of the same for Tim Burton, except in that kind of weird situation, like you just said, where, you know,
and of course,
Sondheim did it first.
Yeah, and of course, Danny Elfman still does music for The Simpsons to this day.
Yeah.
Yeah, he wrote the, you know, the famous Simpsons theme song. Da, da, that's Danny Elfman, yeah. And he did all the song, all the music for it, for the show. He still does it to this day, and I hope that he continues to do it for as long as, until The Simpsons become unprofitable.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, it's great. It's still strangely, the music on The Simpsons is the one thing that's never kind of tanked, I guess. You know, you can kind of debate all the other stuff in Simpsons, but that music, man.
So let's move on. Again, this was developed through Walt Disney's Animation Studio. This was supposed to be part of the Disney Renaissance. This was slotted right there between Aladdin and The Lion King. So doing it at this point in our talk of the Renaissance era makes sense to me. I don't know about it makes sense to you.
But you know what? It's Christmas, and everything freaking stops for Christmas.
True. Everything stops for Christmas. So
it doesn't matter. It just happens to be neat that it falls into that same thing.
So yeah, but it was just the powers that be at Disney thought that it was a little too dark for the Disney brand. So it was released through Touchstone Pictures, which is Disney's studio that they own that was specifically for PG, PG-13, R-rated movies. So whenever someone says, oh, Disney doesn't do R-rated movies, look at Touchstone's library.
Yeah.
Pretty Woman is a Disney movie.
Well, but remember, you said Touchstone, and you're correct that Touchstone was the kind of PG-13, you know, PG-13, not quite kids movies, but not like really disturbing stuff.
Mm-hmm.
If you wanted to talk about hard R entertainment in Disney, that's why they bought Miramax.
Yeah.
So Miramax was really, you had the three levels of Disney. You had, you know, vanilla flavored Disney, which was, this is family entertainment, bring the kids, you know, G, PG only. Then you had Touchstone for your PG, PG-13. You might get a soft R in there, but it wasn't going to be anything too bad. And then Miramax was for, you know,
Kill Bill.
Whatever. Yeah, was for, you know, Tarantino and stuff. Yeah.
That's a thing right there. Kill Bill is a Disney movie, folks.
Clerks.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was just after the Disney buyout was released. So yeah, that's crazy.
But considering that at this era of Disney, they had only released one PG movie under the Disney brand, which was The Black Cauldron, again, which Burton worked on, and that didn't do so well. So they would be a little hesitant to want to release another PG movie under the Disney brand.
Yeah.
Of course, you know, the movie becomes a cult classic, a family favorite. Everyone loves Jack Skellington, so Disney goes, oh, come home with Jack. You are now under the Disney brand. We're going to re-release your movie with the Walt Disney logo. We're going to have you in the theme parks. Oh, by the way, everyone who grew up with your movie is an adult now. Here's some merchandise. Give us some more money. And it worked.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Super duper worked.
Can't go into a freaking Hot Topic without seeing something Nightmare related.
Jack Skellington is like the official, you know, mascot of Hot Topic now, I'm convinced. Because you see so much, which I'm not complaining about. Every time I go into Hot Topic, I look for, you know, it's like that stuff. But
especially around this time of year, between Halloween and Christmas, they really ramp up the Nightmare merchandise, Nightmare brand Christmas sweaters and the like.
Yeah. I respect a movie that can go from my favorite holiday to my, maybe not my least favorite holiday, but it's kind of down there. Don't at me, bah, humbug. So.
Okay, so I think that's all we can talk about the non-movie portion of this episode. So let's get into the movie, if you don't mind. Originally, Patrick Stewart was supposed to be the narrator for this movie.
And I honestly think it really suffers that they didn't go with that.
He recorded it. It's on the soundtrack. If you have the soundtrack to the movie, Patrick Stewart's narration is on there.
Yeah, but what they went with, I noticed in my rewatch, I was like, man, I really remember this being more impactful narration. It really just kind of sits there like a dead fish. All apologies to the voice actor who probably didn't know he was doing the final version when he recorded that, I'm going to guess. Because
I want to believe this is Danny Elfman. I'm not sure.
It's not. If I remember correctly, it's the same guy who does the mayor. No, not the mayor, Santa. It's the same guy who does Santa, I believe.
Maybe because... Okay, that makes sense, because there's something I want to talk about later.
Yes, it is, in fact, the guy that does the voice of Santa Claus. I confirm that.
Okay, that makes sense, considering what I want to talk about after we talk about the movie.
Yeah.
And those of you who know the soundtrack kind of know where I'm going with this.
Yeah.
But anyway, we start with what I call the Forest of Holidays, which is all the trees with all the holiday logos on them, and you get, you know, the explanation of where all the holidays come from. And you see, it's a weird selection of the holidays that they use for this.
And very American.
Yeah, 4th of July, Valentine's Day, St. Patrick's Day, Easter, Thanksgiving, Christmas, and Halloween.
And several of those are only really a big deal in America, or either Thanksgiving, yes, there's Canadian Thanksgiving, you know, shout out to our friends in Canada, but...
That's a month before ours.
but, you know, the kind of Thanksgiving turkey pastiche is very American. You know, you said 4th of July.
The firecracker right there, yeah.
And then St. Patrick's Day is really only a thing in America.
Mm-hmm.
Like the Irish celebrate it a little bit. My friends from Ireland have told me, yeah, we celebrate it, but it's more like a day you go to church and stuff. It's not really like a day you go out and sing all the songs and get drunk and stuff. They're like, if you want to do that, you go to America. And so, the fact that St. Patrick's Day is in there is kind of also really American. So, I don't know, it's just a very kind of like...
Yeah, very American-centric choices of holidays.
I have a theory on that, and I'll get back to it when we get a little further in the movie.
Alright, so let's go to the opening number, This is Halloween. The introduction of Halloween Town, and similar to what I said in Aladdin, it pretty much makes Halloween Town a character in itself in the movie.
Yeah, and I love it. It's also probably the catchiest earworm in the movie.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of, this is Halloween, this is Halloween, really sticks in your head so bad.
and that melody is replayed over and over in this movie, very much like a Broadway musical, where you get the musical reprises, maybe not the vocal repeats, but you get that the music of it is played several times over in the film.
Yeah, and Elfman is excellent at using those Broadway style motifs to go with characters. Mm-hmm. And it really shines in this one. Some of his other movies, there's just not the ability in a lot of ways to do it. But in this one, he uses it to full effect. Like every time Sally is on screen, you get Sally's song. You know, even before you've heard Sally's song, it's just you're used to that being the music you hear when she walks on screen.
Yeah.
Which is very effective, I think, musically. So bravo for use of that.
And all these characters, the clown with the tearaway face, that's always good, you know, all these characters. And then, of course, you meet our primary characters for this film. You got the mayor, played by Glenn Shaddix. Sally, played by Catherine O'Hara. Again, a Beetlejuice actor. Oogie Boogie, played by stage legend Ken Page, who, little note for those who are wondering, was in the original Broadway production of Cats, and that's opening in a few weeks in the theaters.
Yes.
Yeah. There's a connection. And, of course, Jack Skellington, which we talked about before. Danny Elfman doing the singing voice, Chris Sarandon doing the speaking voice. And the introduction of Jack Because we saw the Scarecrow at the very beginning of the number holding the signs as Halloween Town. Now we find out Jack's been in that costume this whole time. Sets himself on fire and he comes out as the Pumpkin King.
That Jack's reveal is probably one of the coolest shots in the movie to me. You know, him just rising up and the way his collar just kind of unfolds and pops out.
Yeah.
It's such a great and subtle animation work. And some of that subtlety is really difficult to get in stop motion. And this movie is brilliant about the tiny and smooth little details. So, really just, especially for the time as well, they really kicked it up a notch, technologically speaking.
Yeah, and in that whole opening number is a nice combination of both stop motion and a little bit of 2D animation with the ghosts. Even with Zero, as we go through the movie.
Yeah. Zero's reveal comes a little bit later after the song, but Zero's reveal is also very cool, the way that he just rises kind of similarly to Jack, in that same kind of like, ooh, and then he's just there,
So Jack is the Pumpkin King, but what does that mean? Is he the ruler of Halloween Town, or is he simply the person that puts together the Halloween celebration? Because we know there's a mayor.
Yeah, and it's Halloween Town, not Halloween Land, not Halloween Kingdom, Halloween Town.
Is it like the king of the parade or something,
Is it a ceremonial position? I don't know. Everybody fawns over Jack, so is he like a local celebrity without much political power? Because this was in my notes too when I was rewatching it, and I'm like, who exactly is in charge here? Because the mayor is very obviously the mayor. He walks around like he has political power, but does he? Because he doesn't really do anything other than act as a sort of town crier in a lot of ways. And hand out the awards at the beginning of the movie.
Yeah.
So I'm saying that no matter who has the title, Jack is running this show. The whole thing.
Jack Lee's, we're getting ahead of ourselves, but Jack Lee's for one day and the entire town was crazy.
Yeah.
So whether he actually has any kind of power or not, Jack's in charge.
Yeah.
So let's talk about Sally's father, Dr. Finkelstein, played by William Hickley.
Yeah, William Hickey was so great. He was just one of the great character actors. And this was a few years before his death. I mean, he was already quite, he was already in his 60s by this point. So, not extremely old, but, he was, man, he was so fun whenever you'd see him on a TV show in the 80s and 90s, just wandering through.
Yeah, he's not happy that Sally had poisoned him to get out of the house. And, you can kind of feel for Sally. She wants that bit of freedom herself. She just wants to be part of society, and the doctor just wants to lock her up and keep her all to himself.
Another Disney princess who just wants escape.
Well, considering the end of the movie, does
Jasmine, count? Ariel, they are all hanging out somewhere, trying to figure out a way to get away from their overbearing father.
Well, Sally does hook up with a king. Does that make her royalty?
I mean, if that Pumpkin King is an actual title and not just a nicety of the town, then yeah. I am fully for Sally being a full-on Disney princess.
Yep. Clever Sally undoes her own arm to get away from her, let's say, abusive father? Or verbal abuse, if nothing else.
We never quite understand their relationship other than he is very possessive in a I made you kind of way. Which,
yeah.
He did literally make her, so, there is that.
But she does have free will, so.
Yeah. And we also know that this is not the first time she's used that poison trick to get out of the house. Because he's like, really? Again? You've done He seems more mildly annoyed than really put out by the deadly nightshade.
Yeah. It's like, can you stop poisoning me, girl?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not going to let you go out, but can you stop poisoning me?
It's a chicken and the egg there, Dr. Finkelstein, you know? Yeah. Like, maybe she wouldn't poison you if you'd let her have a night out now and then.
And, you actually get to see that Sally's appendages actually are have the, you know, the, their own function, even though they're not attached to Sally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's good. Because the arm is just punching the doctor right in the head.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So everyone loves Jack. Great Halloween, Jack. This is the best one ever. But Jack's not feeling it. It's just like last year and the year before that and the year before that. It's like, He's kind of bored with the whole doing the same thing year after year after year. And honestly, if you're doing the same thing every year for a certain any kind of event, you do kind of get tired of it. So you kind of feel for Jack on that.
I mean, once again, it's a Disney character that's very trapped in their social role. Maybe Jack is also a Disney princess. Because
sure.
That really is a thing more princesses get than, you know, Disney male heroes. Maybe Aladdin a little bit, but I guess when you're looked down as a street rat, anybody's going to want out of that, you know.
So, and this is kind of the part where we introduce to the ghost dog, Zero. And he has a glowing nose. Keep that in mind for later in the movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anything else you want to talk about this scene? Or you want to move on to Jack's lament?
I really love Zero, just kind of as a Tim Burton and dogs. There are so many iconic dogs in Tim Burton movies. And they're always so really neat. I mean, the dog in Corpse Bride...
Mm-hmm.
Also very similar to Zero because you get another deceased dog and everything. And then he made the whole Frankenweenie movie, which is Frankenstein, but with a dog. And everything, and they're just all these kind of little iconic dog moments. So I'm guessing Tim Burton must really have a thing for dogs.
Maybe, you know, his dog. So Jack's bored of Halloween, doing the same thing year to year, lost for something new. The iconic scene, more or less, at least for me, would be the part where he takes his head off and does these Shakespearean quotations thing, you know, that general push it. Yes, I am a dead person.
Yeah, he doesn't just have the external look of a skeleton. It's not makeup, it's not a Halloween costume. He is actual just skeletal bones.
So, who was he when he was alive? That's the question.
Or was he ever alive?
No, it's true.
I mean, has he always just perpetually been the pump? Like, when humans started celebrating Halloween, did he just exist? You know, I did my master's thesis on the Discworld series, and death in the Discworld is a seven-foot-tall skeleton, very much like Jack. And he's a seven-foot-tall skeleton because that's what humans expect him to be. That if humans just one day started being like, death is a giant bear, he would become a bear. Human expectation. So I've always kind of wondered, do we have Santa Claus in this movie is absolutely impacted by the American expectation of Santa Claus, which was created almost entirely whole cloth by the Coca-Cola Corporation.
Yeah.
So is Jack kind of the same way when you think of how Americans celebrate Halloween? And who would be in charge of that giant, scary skeleton?
So Sally's been watching this whole thing, gathering the deadly nightshade for another round of poisoning the doctor. And she knows this. She understands Jack. She understands the idea of wanting something new. The two very much kindred spirits in this regard.
And we get the shot of the movie right here in this song right up front. We always talk about the iconic shot from the movies we do, and during Jack's lament, he walks up that crazy hill with the spiral tip against the moonlight. And some version of that, either him coming up the hill or him walking down as the hill, you know, lets out its tendril or whatever down below, some version of that is the iconic shot from this. I mean, most of the posters have some version of it. The trailer had that mountain featured, that little hill or whatever featured prominently all throughout the trailer, you know. If you ever see a clip show where they're like, and remember Nightmare Before Christmas, that's going to be the shot they use.
Yeah.
So,
you know, Sally doesn't really follow Jack as he wanders off to who knows where, because, yeah, the doctor still has her arm, and she kind of needs that back.
It's nice to have all your limbs if you have access to them, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and this is where you mentioned before, where Dr. Finkelstein pretty much implies that he owns Sally. You know, he gave her life, he owns her.
Yeah. Not cool.
No.
Note to parents, you do not own your children.
No. But, you know, the doctor does sew the arm back on, so it's not completely, you know... He's still horrible, but he's not, you know, he's still going to help his, quote, daughter. We're still not sure on that one.
I do wonder if, once again, kind of spoiler alert ahead in the movie, I do kind of wonder if Sally was intended more of like a Bride of Finkelstein kind of situation rather than the daughter kind of mode that she seems to have fallen into.
Possibly.
But I do wonder if he gave her her arm back more because he wants her to go make soup for him.
Yeah.
I think it was probably a selfish move. He doesn't really seem to have any empathy toward any other people or wanting to help any other people. He seems very selfish and self-directed.
Yeah. So let's go back to Jack and Zero, and like you said, dog moment, as Jack kicks one of his own rib bones out and plays fetch with Zero.
Which is adorable! Aww.
And we find out that Zero's nose not only lights up, but can light up dark places. I wonder if that'll play into the rest of the movie.
It might be a point to realize, to state that when we didn't doing... the overview before, but Tim Burton was absolutely inspired by several other famous holiday stories you may have heard of.
Yeah. So the mayor, let's get to the mayor. He goes to Jack's home, humming, "This is Halloween." There's another reprise there. He's not here. And probably one of the most funniest lines in the movie: "Jack, I'm only an elected official. I can't make a decision by myself."
Yeah, they really did harp on the, like, politicians are icky idea with this dude. He's literally two-faced.
Yep.
His head switches around from happy to sad. You know, he seems to have no actual effective power in the town, like we said.
Yeah, he just seemed to be just a symbol of having a mayor because, well, they're a town, they need some sort of elected official, we'll vote you, you're the mayor now.
Yeah, so it kind of makes you wonder what their thoughts on politicians there were.
I mean, Tim Burton's.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know if it was like him or the screenplay or what, but yeah.
So Jack finally ends up into the forest that we were at the beginning of the film. Sees the holiday doors on the trees, and sees the shiny Christmas tree door, and he ends up in Christmas Town. Is there anything you want to say before we go into what's this?
No.
All right, what's this? The iconic song from the movie that everyone knows. That scene of Jack in the snow, Jack in the snowman, Jack just this. the big smile that Jack has as soon as he sees the very bright and colorful world of Christmas Town.
Yeah. I used to have a snow globe that played this song. I did get it at Hot Topic, so there you go.
I saw that same one at Walgreens the other day.
Oh, that hurts my heart so much.
So it's like, this is the something new that Jack has been looking for. At least he believes it is. And, you know, the general contrast between the world he's used to and this new world he's seeing. You know, there's no monsters under the bed. These people are kissing under mistletoe, electric lights on strings. Like, no one's dead. Everything is bright, colorful, full of life. And it's like, it's very beautiful in the way they made Christmas Town look. And especially the look of and just general Jack's own reactions to seeing these for the first time. I mean, those of us, we can't even remember the first time we saw anything Christmassy, you know?
Yeah, I mean, especially anybody that grew up in the U.S. Uh-huh. You saw it from the second you exited the womb, so.
Yeah.
The color palette is really the thing that stands out to me. The design of the town is definitely different. You know, it seems very traditional kids movie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they are very definitely drawing from some of the famous Christmas specials. You know, there's a little bit of Charlie Brown's Christmas special, a little bit of Dr. Seuss, and a little bit of, you know, I mean, there's some various things they're pulling from there. But the color palette is amazing because Halloween Town is very much browns and grays and blacks and very, very muted. And then suddenly, even the plants, I mean, because you see the plants around there and they're all kind of gray and brown and, you know, not at all colorful. But everything in Halloween Town that's not covered with snow is just really bright and vibrant.
And back in Halloween Town, the mayor's lost it. Jack's only been gone one day, and this mayor is about ready to just lose his mind. That shows you the influence of Jack in this town, is that he's only gone for a day, and everyone at least the mayor is panicking.
Yeah.
One of the attentions to detail, I put in here, attention to detail, that the vampires carry umbrellas to protect them from the sun.
Yeah. Bravo for them. You know.
Yeah, so it's like that little detail of the vampires. If the vampires are going to be out in the sunlight, they got to have some kind of protection.
And not a lot of sunlight in Halloween Town because it's always overcast.
Yeah.
But even so.
Yeah. Sally, she's quite the chemist to put all these chemicals together to make the poison for the doctor.
I'm not sure you'd call it chemistry so much as, you know. I know people that mess around with stuff like this. There is a very particular type of woman, and it's the type of woman who would be very into this movie, trust me. who kind of has, I'm thinking of at least four people in my life right now, but you all know who you are. You know, that has like a little section in their garden that's fenced off where the cats can't go. That's all like, oh, you know, I've got some nightshade, I've got this, that. I have a friend who grew a corpse flower in her living room this past year to full maturity and fragrant bloom. Yeah.
Yeah.
So Sally's that type of chick. I'm not sure it's necessarily a chemist, but very specific botanist, perhaps.
Yeah. Well, she knows her way around the ingredients. Hanging around with a scientist, she would learn something. But she seems to have picked up more than the scientist has intended her to know. Maybe?
Yeah.
But she's making the soup for Dr. Finkelstein. And she's poisoning him again. The doctor opening his skull up and scratching his brain. I have my notes. Ew.
And also very, I don't know, that's kind of an interesting peculiarity for a mad scientist to have. Mad scientists are very much a Halloween thing. You know, we think of them in relation to Halloween. But mad scientists with a hinged brain that are also kind of, I don't really know what he is, but it's slightly strange and fascinating.
And the very clever way Sally is tricking the scientist or Dr. Finkelstein to drink the poison by having the slit spoon.
Yeah, that's really neat. I always liked that as a kid. I've spilled it, and then let me pick up that fan off the floor and doing the really kind of cool switch.
Yeah. And he falls for it. You know, he drinks the whole thing. So Jack comes back in a sled. Did he steal it from Halloween? Did he steal this little ski thing from Halloween to Christmas Town?
Yeah, he stole so much from Christmas Town, though. He's got all that stuff that he shows them later in the theater in the next scene.
So let's just go to that next scene, the town meeting. It says a lot that the song is called the Town Meeting Song.
Some of these song names are very Sebastian the Crab in their naming. You've got Sally's song. You've got what's this? You've got this is Halloween.
Danny Elfman, what are you doing?
Danny Elfman went to the Sebastian the Crab School of Songwriting.
Apparently. So Jack tries to describe Christmas to a bunch of people who have never heard of it. I mean, it's like if you ever tried to describe something that you love to another person who has never heard of it, it's a very frustrating experience.
Every goth knows this. Like, this was definitely a movie made for the goth kids, and we all knew this. It's really cool because there's spiders, and then a bat comes down, and it's all like, yeah. It's Marilyn from the Monsters.
Yeah.
You know, it's the one normie in the family trying to explain the normal world.
Yeah. So, like, I mean, and again, you got to kind of feel for Jack. He's trying to explain it, but he doesn't know how. And he just says, well, I better give them what they want. And he describes it the way that they can understand it, especially the description of Sandy Claus.
Sandy Claus,
and they call him Sandy Claus, and it's like, and the people of Halloween Town, they love this idea, based on how he explained it.
Yeah.
But it's like they don't. He still like they don't understand it. They don't understand why I like this stuff.
I like that he describes Sandy Claus as a lobster enthusiast. a little joke there for some of the people in our lives. But he's red and he's got claws. What's red and got claws? It's a lobster. He's a big giant lobster, dude.
And he slays a lot.
And he slays everything in sight.
So it's like he's trying to figure out how to explain this to the people. When in doubt, science. And he pulls up the scientific method book, and I love that.
Yeah.
So.
And goes to the mad scientist and is like, what to do experiments.
Keep in mind that the doctor has woken up from his poison and has locked Sally away in her room. Again,
he needs to rename Deadly Nightshade as Mildly Inconveniencing Nightshade, because what's going on, girl?
Well, it's Halloween, and if all of these characters are supposed to be dead, you can't really kill something that's already dead.
I mean, is the doctor dead? That would be interesting.
I don't know. Who was Sally before she was reanimated?
Sally appears to be kind of a... I don't know, like a...
Mostly ragdoll.
A ragdoll, or perhaps part scarecrow or something? Depending on the shot, her limbs seem to be filled with different things.
I noticed leaves are mostly in her body.
Leaves are mostly the stuffing, But it doesn't really, it seems to have like the appearance of a human body, but there doesn't seem to be much like traditional Frankenstein, I pieced you together from a corpse.
Yeah.
So
let's see. Let's move on, Jack. Dr. Finkelstein gave Jack a very, very nice science kit. You gotta admit that.
Yeah, he's got a lot of really cool test tubes and beakers and random chemicals and stuff.
And he breaks one of them right at the start.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, man, that's a... Oh, boy. Because he's trying to figure out what does it all mean. What did these berries do? What does this ornament do? What is cotton, apparently?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, still, science fails Jack, unfortunately. Science fails him because he still has no idea what any of it means. Sally. Sally using her skills to make a nice little basket of goodies for Jack.
The adorable little smoke butterfly that comes out of the bottle. So cute.
And Sally jumping out the window straight up. Like, she's not even taking the rope down. She's just jumping for it.
She appears completely immortal and indestructible in the traditional sense, because even when she's detached, her body parts move separately. So,
yeah, she's literally pulling herself back together. That's a thing for a therapist one day. Of course, the doc finds out Sally skipped again. Not happy. I have to laugh at Jack's Christmas equation.
The Christmas equation is very adorable.
And there's so many references in that one equation. There's like 10 different Christmas songs are referenced in that one equation.
Yeah, and I like he draws a little lobster claw for Santa Claus.
Yeah.
For Sandy Claus, yeah.
The square root of chestnuts over an open fire.
I really love that one, yeah, that's great. Great bit. That's definitely one when you're doing a rewatch, pause that and just look at everything
on that
board.
Whole chalkboard. See if you can get all the references. Jack gets the gift basket and he immediately looks out and he sees Sally there. So it's like, this is the first time in the movie these two have interacted. I don't know if they already know each other or not, because it's never clear in the movie.
I mean, later on, he does seem to respect her skills. Mm-hmm. So he seems at least vaguely aware of her as a member of his community.
Yeah.
Maybe not any sort of personal knowledge, but, you know, she's that chick who does that stuff.
Yeah.
At the very least.
That chick you always see in the back of the room who does the thing that everyone thinks is funny, but you don't really know her name. You know? She's that girl. She's that girl that you kind of see her everywhere. You don't really know her name.
Yeah.
So, Sally she just runs off. She's like, Jack tries to look at her one more time and she's gone. She's just, but she doesn't really. She doesn't leave because I'm kind of skipping her, but Sally's vision.
Yeah.
Sally's vision of a burning Christmas tree. Again, Sally has a lot of abilities in this movie. Not only she has the ability of the useful of the chemicals, but she can see the future apparently.
Yeah.
So what is the doctor doing with this girl? What does she make this girl for?
I don't. Yeah. Or was that even intentional?
Yeah, that could have been an accidental side effect of whatever experiment he used to create her. Jack's obsession. Still no idea what Christmas means. No idea. And then we get, Zero. Zero, what did you do? Giving him the picture of himself. You know, giving Jack the picture of himself. Because this is kind of the moment where Jack kind of gets his epiphany or something of, you know, maybe Christmas isn't all that difficult after all. Maybe all of this stuff doesn't mean anything. And then he goes, Christmas should be for everyone. No, Christmas is for me. Me and only me. And
thus we get Jack's heel turn.
And the music changes too. I noticed that when I'm listening to it. Like the song is very much minor-ish until that moment, and it gets really minor-ish. Like it's like the music is turning evil just as Jack is kind of turning too.
Yeah, and I like the interesting thing is that, you know, the dog brings him the picture, I think, in more of a kind of remember who you are kind of way.
Yeah.
This
is who you are. You're Jack. This is what you do. And it's like, no, I could be more. I could be more than Jack. I could be Sandy Claus.
Yeah, and it's, you know, I don't know. It's one of those, like, you took the exact wrong lesson from this dude. So you know that that dog is just thinking, like, oh, what's wrong with you, man?
Can we just go play fetch in the forest some more?
Yeah, take your rib out, throw it, I'll go get it. It'll be great.
So yeah, the scene of him taking the string of Christmas lights and wrapping it around the electric chair, that's a great shot right there. It's not the shot, but it's a great kind of solidifying that heel turn, kind of that symbolism of, you know, what he's planning to do with Christmas. Next day, Jack has jobs for the entire town. We are doing Christmas. And enter Locke, Shock, and Beryl. Locke, played by Paul Reubens. Shock, Catherine O'Hara, again. And Beryl, Danny Elfman, again.
Yeah, and I'm going to say, I haven't really talked about Catherine O'Hara's voice in doing Sally. But Catherine O'Hara, who I adore, and I have loved her in everything she's ever been in. I'm currently watching her show right now that she's in called Schitt's Creek. And it is, she's brilliant in it. And she does some kind of strange vocal work in that. But, you know, I am not a person that is easily fooled by voices, but there is so little of her voice in Sally. It's really impressive. Because it doesn't entirely sound like a character voice.
Yeah, it sounds like a natural.
But it really, it has, you know, her normal speaking voice is generally much deeper and more resonant and very kind of smoky and silky and stuff like that, you know, and Sally is very much a kind of high-pitched, very young-sounding, you know, voice. And all, but strangely, her voice for Shock sounds a lot more like herself, even though it's a younger character and she's trying to sound even younger there.
Yeah.
You know, she's trying to sound like a little girl with that one, but there's more of her own kind of natural speaking voice in that. That one I can go, like, yeah, that's obviously Catherine O'Hara, but Sally, even knowing it's her, it's so hard to hear her in that, and bravo for that. I mean, it's a really interesting...
Big, I mean, but Catherine O'Hara, she was a Second City person, so it's like, that's a lot of comedic timing she could put in that. Same with Paul Reubens. Problem is, you know, being a stage comedian.
Yeah, and I mean, they're great, and she's so good with voices if you watch her, you know, career. And she's doing some stuff in her most recent series that you're like, I don't even, as a linguist, I'm listening to it going, I have no idea how she's doing this. It's so impressive, and it draws from so many different sources. So she's a much better voice actor, not in the classical sense, but she's much better with voices than people give her credit for, I think.
Kudos to the mayor, because he says those are Oogie's boys, specifically saying boys, as because Shock is clearly a girl.
I mean, I don't know. We don't know how she identifies.
True. Jack has a special job for them. Kidnap the Sandy Claus. And this is probably one of the most fun songs in the movie.
It is very adorable. The way that they do that. And you can tell that all the actors are having so much fun singing this song.
Especially, again, Danny Elfman trying to sound like a kid.
Yeah.
And yeah, Danny Elfman is doing the actual dialogue voice of Beryl. as opposed to just, you know, just so people can know. Yeah, they're planning to really turn on Jack. Like, they have no intention of being loyal to Jack whatsoever, and are completely planning on giving the entire plan to Oogie Boogie. Santa Claus, the entire Christmas thing, all going to Oogie Boogie. Because that's what they do. They are Oogie's boys. What movie can we tell about the scene else besides that? I mean, just them being very mischievous throughout the whole thing, even to each other.
Yeah.
And they're supposed to be on the same side, and they're, like, pulling pranks on each other. Like, Beryl taking the water out of the bathtub before they dive in.
They are very fun characters, the way that they're kind of written and animated.
Yeah.
They are the trick part of the trick-or-treaters. You know, they're dressed like trick-or-treating little kids, but they are very definitely the sort of kids that you'd give them a full-size candy bar and they'd still TP your house. So
yeah, they doesn't matter if you're giving them candy bars or fruit or pennies, they're egging your house. Jack wants Sally to make the Santa Claus suit, and again, he already knows her name. Maybe because of the note, maybe they already knew each other. That's my big thing about this. Like, we're not quite sure if they already know each other or not. But he does call her by name, Sally. And wants her to make the Santa Claus suit. And Sally is just pleading to Jack to not do this. This is wrong. This is not the way we're supposed to do this. You're the Pumpkin King. You're not Santa Claus. And Jack is just dismissing this idea. No, no, no. It's going to be fine. That's not, you know, my Christmas isn't going to end up in flames. My Christmas is going to be amazing. And yeah, Jack is completely deluded at this point. He's just gone. Jack is not here right now. I'll leave a message at the beep.
You know, this has an unfortunate tie-in in a long list of movies. Where a woman tells you exactly what's going to happen, and then some dude is like, crazy woman, this will never happen the exact way you just told me it will.
Titanic is unsinkable, young lady.
Yeah, I'm thinking more of Alien, which I've recently, in the last couple of years, heard described as a movie about a woman who was right about everything and all the dead men who told her that she was wrong.
And I love that. Well, we're getting ahead, but... Yeah, and if people are telling Sally's the only one with any sense around here.
Yeah. So, you know, I don't know, maybe just listen a little more sometimes is all I've got to say for certain people.
Listen to your woman, guys. Listen to your woman. She's right. She may not always be right, but 9 times out of 10, she's right.
So,
go ahead.
But here's what I was talking about. I mean, he immediately knows Sally as a seamstress, presumably from how many times she's had to put herself together. And I'm guessing she probably made that dress, let's just be honest.
Yeah.
So, you know, the idea, and it turns out he's not wrong, because when she delivers on the outfit, it's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
So...
The kids are back. They caught the Easter Bunny.
That poor Easter Bunny.
Bunny! I just love that. When I first saw that movie, I just laughed out loud as a kid when the guy just said, Bunny!
Yeah, and you know that rabbit was immediately like, this is not the place that I need to be.
Oh, God, Skeleton. Oh, God, he's taking his holiday back.
Yeah. I really hope that the kids took the Easter Bunny back. I hope only good things happen to the Easter Bunny after that. Because we know what those kids are like, and Jack's like, take him back home before you go get the real Santa Claus, and apologize. Yeah.
And it's like, okay, so it takes them less than a day to find the Easter Bunny, but because of this whole montage that happens afterwards, it takes them 35 days to find Santa Claus.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I didn't even think about that.
So are they constantly coming back with different the different rulers of each holiday?
Yeah, there's like a little leprechaun that shows up drunk.
There's Cupid.
Cupid.
Turkey. You know,
poor Uncle Sam just gets dragged into the This isn't very America at all.
Speaking of that, I gotta say that we kind of skipped over it, but Jack apparently knows of the outside world, so he does mention France and Kentucky in his first song. So they are at least aware of the outside world.
Yeah. And a country outside of America, which the rest of the movie doesn't really seem to want to do. Although, you know what? I gotta say, back to my Uncle Sam thing, I really can't think of anything more American than going to somebody's home and just dragging them and taking them back to your home for your own purposes. So maybe Uncle Sam was right.
Taking the collar there. making Christmas! And we see Halloween Town getting ready for Christmas their way by making their little demonic toys. We see Christmas Town making the traditional Christmas toys. And you don't quite see Santa yet. You kind of see him more in shadows. At this point, we haven't seen Santa Claus in full Santa Claus yet. You know, we've seen shadows. We may see a part of him. We don't see the full Santa yet.
Yeah, we see hands or boots or something. up until.
So it's like both towns are getting ready, and we ended up fast-forwarding to Christmas Eve. Santa, played by Ed Ivory, is checking the list twice, because that's what he does. Lock, Shock, and Barrel show up, and they kidnap Santa Claus.
Finally.
Again, it took them 35 days.
Yeah.
how many holiday figures that they took. Sally's still worried. Jack's still ignoring her. And the way Sally's saying it's wrong. Like, she straight up knows what they're doing is wrong. Like, it's one review I read equates this to like cultural appreciation or something like that.
The person that introduced me to that concept was, of course, Todd in the Shadows, who I very much recommend you go watch as a music reviewer, and this movie was what he used to explain cultural appropriation to his audience, and
thank you. I couldn't say that.
I saw that, and I was like, that's very... I would also say that it's a little bit of colonization as well. In what they're doing, and that never goes well. Spoiler alert for literally all of human history, colonization not really a thing. But, you know, the problem doesn't start when Jack wants to enjoy Christmas. It's when he decides he can do Christmas better than the people who created Christmas.
Yep.
And that's when everything goes wrong. You know, it's when he says, go to their place and take their people, take their stuff,
steal from them,
bring me Santa Claus, bring me their... I mean, the first thing he does is steal from Christmas Town.
Yeah.
You know, and then it's, I know how to do this better. I don't understand it. We've already pointed out that he doesn't understand Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's used science, he's used whatever, and it's when he decides, like you said, this is about me.
Yeah.
That he becomes the villain very clearly in the movie. Mm-hmm. So I think that the connection that Todd made there is not an inappropriate one.
Mm-hmm.
Even if he was the first one to, I don't know where he came up with the idea himself, but that's definitely where I saw it.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a perfect way to kind of view this movie, that and the kind of colonial thing. And the fact that it is so tied with America, I mean, it really, really is a very American movie in the sense of the holidays it focuses on, and specifically how the holidays are celebrated. Halloween is not celebrated like this in other countries.
No.
America has a very kind of peculiar way of celebrating Halloween, which is what this movie is based on. We have a very peculiar way of celebrating Christmas. Which is also, you know, what it's based on. And so the idea that you would decide, like, these are the people who are experts at the thing. This is their culture. I mean, it is. It's their entire town is built on this. This is their world, their, you know, the town, their country, whatever you want to call it. And to go like, well, obviously I know better how that should be celebrated or done, or if we take the veneer of your culture and shove it onto my culture. Because Jack's Christmas, you know, when they're making Christmas, it's 99% Halloween, even the stuff Jack's doing.
Mm-hmm.
What does he do when he puts on the Sandy Claus outfit? He just puts it over his normal Halloween outfit.
He's just putting on a costume. Yep. Even his own ho 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 ends up cackling laughter.
Yeah. So, you know, and his reindeer are reanimated skeletons, and his, you know, I mean, you know, the festive hats are
dead animals.
Dead animals, you know, rats and bats, you know, turned into things. Everything's got to rhyme. Stupid musicals. But yeah,
it is based off a poem.
Yeah. So I love that kind of reading and that way of approaching it, because honestly, slightly spoiler alert for kind of the end of the episode, in rewatching this, I kind of wondered, like, what was this movie trying to say? There's not really a lot here. This movie is almost entirely aesthetic and almost zero plot. Other than kind of a vague, Jack should embrace who he is and be the Halloween guy and just, you know, celebrate Christmas when Santa comes to visit or whatever. There's not really like a moral of the story. There's not really, you know? And so I think this is really the only way you can read it where it has any depth beyond, wouldn't it be funny to have jack-o'-lanterns at Christmas time? You know, I don't know.
So, you know, let's move on. Let's move on. Jack's got the Santa Claus suit on. He's saying something's missing. And the kids bring in Santa Claus. And they find out that, oh, he doesn't have claws at all. He's just a dude. He's not a monster. He's a dude. He's just a fat guy.
Yeah.
And Jack takes his hat. That's just personal property, man.
Yeah. That's insult to injury.
Yeah, he just takes his hat saying, oh, I'm going to give you a vacation starting right now. Take him somewhere nice. Of course, the kids are going to take him to Oogie Boogie because that was their plan the whole time.
Yeah. Because where's nicer than going to Oogie Boogie?
Yeah. So, Sally. Again, Sally tries one last desperate attempt to stop Jack with the fog juice. And is making it fog, you know, she has the fog juice. She's going to make the entire town foggy so that they can't launch. Jack has to stop the whole thing. And hopefully everything can go back to normal tomorrow.
I got to get a little animation nerd right now because the use of the fog is beautiful. Because what this is it's not a 2D animation overlay. They have not drawn this on. This is not a CGI overlay. This is, they pumped actual theatrical fog into the sets and filmed it in real time. Which is why it looks so freaking amazing. This is a 100% practical effect. So far as I can tell. Because what they seem to have done here, and granted, I am unfortunately not an animation professional, but stop motion animation is one of my many jams that I love and know a lot about. Instead of doing it frame by frame in the animation, there are parts with the fog where they just let the camera run and kind of show the fog kind of enveloping the town. And then they do like close-up shots and they intersperse it so it's not just like one long shot of all of the characters standing completely motionless while the fog, you know, rolls through. So it's very interestingly edited to make it look like they're still kind of moving. And they may have done something where they had like, you know, somebody moving them from under a table, kind of puppeteering them rather than the traditional stop motion. I'm not entirely sure how they did it, but I would bet everything I own that they just basically turned on a typical film camera and let that fog roll through the set, which is awesome. And I love that they did that because I love any time anything will do a practical effect. And one of the things I love about stop-motion animation is that it's animation that is 100% practical effects. Because all of those things are, you know, they're real, and you can touch them and you can play with them, and they have to build all the sets from scratch, and they have to build all the props. It's not, you know, an animator sitting in a dark room huddled over a sketch pad or something. It's a team of people that are constantly interacting with physical objects, which is what I love about the medium. So I absolutely love that when they were like, oh, she pours what is basically theatrical fog juice. I mean, that's what they call it in the theater. There's, you know, just bottles that are like fog juice. And she just, you know, she pours it in and it,
the whole bottle too.
Yeah. And it vaporizes, through, which is so beautiful. And it, the way it moves and stuff is just so cool. So I love it. And that's by far my favorite part of the movie from an animation perspective, because they really didn't do anything. They just kind of let the physics of it be, you know?
All right, so let's backtrack a bit with the doctor, Dr. Finkelstein, working on his new creation that kind of has the same head shape as him, and he gives his creation half of his own brain.
Yeah.
He takes the left half of his own brain and puts it on the right half of the creation skull. I'm not sure brains work that way.
Well, I'm almost entirely sure that putting half a brain inside of it. Well, I say this as half of my brain is currently in Chicago with another person we know. There is a joke that one of our good friends has the other half of my brain, and we joke that we are the product of an experiment by a mad scientist who did exactly this trick. And Tuesday does a show with both of us.
Yes.
So there you go.
It's a cartoon.
So outside that one weird experience, I'm pretty sure that hemispheres don't cross over like that.
So Locke makes a point. If Santa can fit down a chimney, he can fit down that tube. It's
they're
logic.
Not wrong. I mean, it is a logical idea there. Whatever magic gets him down a chimney should get him through other tight spaces.
True. So, I mean, there's not much to say about those two scenes. But Oogie Boogie song. Again, Ken Page, amazing voice, doing Oogie Boogie. The whole scene, you kind of had hints of it earlier in the film, but Boogie's a gambler. There's a lot of dice rolling. There's a lot of imagery of games of chance. But he, by his own admission, he doesn't play fair.
Yeah.
You know, the house always wins with Oogie Boogie, no matter what.
I've always wondered, we asked the question about Jack and the mayor, but what is Oogie Boogie in this town? Because Jack absolutely hates him.
Mm-hmm.
Before we even meet Oogie Boogie, where he's called a no account, and Jack's already kind of insulting him. Well,
he's straight up the boogeyman. He even says that. He's straight up the boogeyman.
Why would that be a bad thing in Halloween Town? I mean, Jack's chummy with the swamp monster and the vampires and the evil witches and the really depressing New Orleans street trio with the fish accordion. I mean, everybody else there might be a misfit outside of Halloween Town. But they all fit into Halloween Town. And Oogie Boogie would seem to be... I mean, what's Halloween without the boogeyman?
You know, the boogeyman is a central figure in the horror Halloween kind of vibe.
What happened here that these two hate each other?
He doesn't play fair. I think that's there. Maybe there's some sort of sense of honor among the other monsters in the town is that they're still fair, and Oogie he's just gonna do whatever. He's gonna cheat. He's gonna lie. He's gonna steal. And as long as he gets what he wants, and everyone else is like, let's not play that game. Monsters can have honor.
Well, I mean, I'm not saying they can't. I'm just wondering what specific beef went down between Jack and Oogie Boogie. Because we don't hear anybody else in town even mention Oogie Boogie.
Well, the mayor is sick. He's afraid of Oogie Boogie. So obviously the mayor fears Oogie.
Okay, afraid is a different thing. I can understand being afraid of a bully.
Mm-hmm.
But nobody else really seems to care except that Oogie Boogie is a pariah who lives down a tube in the bottom of the... I don't know. It's a very strange dynamic, and the movie never really gets into why he's there. It's just like, okay, now here's your sort of villain for the next ten minutes.
Something happened between these two. Maybe they were both in the running for Pumpkin King and Jack just won.
Yeah, who knows? We don't know how Pumpkin Kings are chosen.
We don't know, but Santa's going to have a bad time, we know that.
Yeah, because Oogie Boogie immediately is like, okay, I'm going to mess with you now.
It's a foggy Christmas Eve, Jack looked down and said, Zero with your nose so bright, won't you guide my sleigh tonight?
Like we said, Tim Burton was drawing from a lot of Christmas stories.
So yeah, Zero is put to the head of the team in this foggy Christmas Eve to lead the way as Jack is off. Plan is back on. We are going. Christmas is a go. And Sally, poor Sally, she's just, please be wrong. Please let my vision be wrong. I want to be wrong in this one. Because, you know, she just wants her friend to be safe. Straight up. That's her reasoning. Jack is her friend, and she wants her friend to be okay, even though she knows what her friend is doing is wrong.
Yeah.
Which leads us to Sally's song. Again, Catherine O'Hara doing a great job with this song.
Catherine O'Hara is a very good singer, and she's done a lot of singing in her other stuff. She was outstanding. She does a lot of the Christopher Guest movies, for those of you who are not familiar with her career. And she did one called A Mighty Wind, which is all about folk musicians and stuff. And she has a song in there with Eugene Levy, who is on Schitt's Creek. Who is one of the co-creators of Schitt's Creek, Eugene Levy and his son. But Her songs in that are beautiful. And yeah, it's supposed to be a comedy, but man, she really puts her all into those songs and sings them with as much sincerity and beauty as, you know, you would expect a 1960s, 70s folk singer to have done it, you know. Hilariously, I heard their big song from A Mighty Wind, A Kiss at the End of the Rainbow, earlier this year, sung by a couple at an Esperanto convention I was at. They had translated the entire song into Esperanto and sang it at Talent Night, and it was beautiful and adorable, and they even did the kiss at the end. It was so cute. And it took me a second, because it was in Esperanto, it took me a second to go, why do I know this song? And then I realized, like, that is a deep, like, we're some nerds. You know, you take, like, because that's such a nerdy film anyway, because who cares about folk music other than nerds like us?
But so many comedians in that movie, too.
Yeah, a nerdy comedy musical that was then translated into one of the nerdiest languages on the planet. So
let's get back here. Sally just wants Jack to know how she feels about him. She actually is harboring these feelings, but it's like she, in her mind, Jack doesn't love her back. You know, Jack only sees her as a friend. She makes that line, you know, it's not to be. I am not the one. You know, I'm not the one that Jack loves.
But you know what I gotta say to Sally? Mm-hmm. Shoot your shot, girl. Has Sally even tried? Like, she takes him a basket of stuff and immediately jumps out a window and runs away. Like, he doesn't even get to say thank you. At the very least, you could stand there for a second so he can thank you for the basket of goodies and then be like, hey, do you want to go have a bubbling cauldron of something tomorrow? I don't know what they do in Halloween Town.
Would you like to go for a walk or something? I know you're busy, you know.
I know you like that weird spiral-shaped hill up in the cemetery. Would you like to go there? Yeah, instead she just kind of stalks him, which, you know, not cool. Maybe don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
So, use your words, Sally, is all I'm saying.
But she does, you know... the second half of that song is, you know, what will become of my dear friend? She's truly worried about Jack, that, you know, this is what's going to happen to Jack.
Yeah.
So that's that whole song is, I love this guy. I don't know if she loves, I don't know if he loves me, but I'm going to be worried about him. Yeah. Simple. Jack's made it to the human world and is delivering his presents. Apparently that's a thing that can happen, because we, you know, we talked about it earlier, Jack knows of the outside world, and has apparently been there, because he says he's known throughout England and France.
Well, we also know that the characters in Halloween Town, they do leave Halloween Town. Jack may not have known about the forest of holidays. But they do talk about going outside, you know, he knows that children's beds are supposed to have a monster underneath it. You know, they talk about going out in the real world during this Halloween. So they visited the real world before, just on that night.
Mm-hmm. Maybe they can only go to the human world on Halloween night.
I don't know whether it's a question of can't or don't.
Yeah.
I mean, do you go and show up at your day job just for giggles? Like, probably not, you know? I mean, most people don't just be like, I think I'll go into the office on my day off. But yeah, I find it interesting that they are aware enough about the world to know what would scare humans. And there's, you know, I mean, there's a variety of phobias out there. Everybody's got different things they find scary. But they, so they know enough about human psychology and the human world to understand the various countries, the various, you know, like you said, you know, France and Kentucky and stuff like that. But they don't know about other human holidays, which is kind of interesting.
Well, it's not Halloween, so I don't think they really care. So, so Jack starts delivering his presents. I remember when this movie first came out, and the commercial they would show on television of the trailer always had the one scene in it, and I remember it vividly. Is the scene where the parents going, "Oh, why did Santa get you, honey?" And the kid shows the shrunken head.
Yeah, that one was absolutely the joke they tried to sell the movie on. And it worked. I mean, when I saw that commercial, I was like, I definitely want to see this movie.
So, you know, Jack is sent delivering his toys, and the toys are attacking. The toys have come to life, and that movie hasn't been made yet. The toys are alive, and Toy Story hasn't been made yet. People are calling the cops.
Oh my goodness. I just wondered. Did Disney base the crazy kid next door on Tim Burton?
That I don't know. I know there was supposed to be a Tim Burton cameo at the end of the movie, and I'll get to that.
Yeah, I just wondered, because you were talking about toys coming to life and, like, things attacking and weird aesthetics and, you know.
Yeah, people are calling the cops, lock your doors, a skeleton is impersonating Santa Claus. I do like that you never see the human adults. You never see their faces.
Very Charlie Brown. Yeah, extremely Charlie Brown. Like I said, they took some stuff from Charlie Brown for Christmas Town as well. So this is just in that aesthetic because we don't really see adults in children's Christmas specials, do we?
No, not a lot, no.
I mean,
other than Santa Claus.
See the adults in Whoville, but they're not human.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you do see the parents of the children in Whoville. But I can't really remember a lot of ones where you see the adults a lot in those kind of 30-minute or an hour Christmas specials that this was based off of.
Where are we going with this? The news report, the cops are, you know, oh, a skeleton, and the entire time, the citizens of Halloween Town, they're watching this whole thing unfold in some sort of reflection pool of some kind?
No, I think it's a witch's cauldron. I think that's what that's supposed to be, is the witches have dialed in on their cauldron.
And Sally's had enough. She is done with all of this clowning around. She's going to find Sandy Claus and fix this. And how does she know where Sandy Claus is at? No one's told anybody. I mean, she says, where is Sandy Claus? And no one's told her.
But she knows, I think. Doesn't she know earlier in the movie who was sent to kidnap Sandy Claus?
Yes, she does know that Lock, Shock, and Barrel have Santa Claus, so
yeah, Boogie seems to live in their basement or whatever. it's not a far stretch.
So yeah. Oh, Sam, what's the best way to get rid of a Santa Claus impersonator? If you said anti-aircraft missiles, you win.
Once again, very American. This is very much NORAD has been tracking Santa.
That I want to see that NORAD track Santa video.
Oh man. Oh. So yeah, we deal with it in the only way Americans can, by getting the military.
So clever for Sally to use her detachability in her attempt to free Santa by trying to seduce Oogie Boogie with the leg.
Yeah, but I mean,
it works.
Yeah, I mean. She's a very smart woman, and she knows what every person wants to hear, really, except for Jack.
Yeah.
She knows what Jack needs to hear, but she doesn't seem to be that great at what Jack wants to hear.
Detaching her hands to untie Sandy Claus, and...
I'm calling it, this is this movie's Secretly Swole. Because her hands are still, like, holding up... Sandy Claus and stuff. I mean, you know, her hands still have some strength to them, even detached from the body. So that's this week's secretly swole character, is Sally.
But it doesn't really go all that well for Sally, because Oogie finds out the leg isn't attached to anything. She turns around, finds Sally, and Sally gets captured too. She tried.
Also, bad Oogie Boogie, because he just goes touching that leg with no permission.
Yeah.
Bad Oogie Boogie, do not touch.
No. You know, missile hits Jack, going down.
He takes it in stride, though. He seems rather chill about it as he's spiraling down.
Well, in Halloween Town, as far as Halloween Town is concerned, Jack has been destroyed, blown to smithereens.
And the mayor does the only thing he does, which is tell people the news. Once again, town crier, not really a mayor.
Yeah. Poor Jack, as in that's the name of the song.
Yeah.
He screwed up, and he knows he screwed up. Yes, he never intended to hurt anybody, and I'm pretty sure he never meant it to go as far as it did. He just wanted to do something good, something new. But at least he tried, and that's his rationale for the whole thing.
But, you know, I mean, it takes him a missile to the face before he realizes that maybe this is a bad plan.
You know that some guys need to be hit by the Clue by Four sometimes.
You want to talk about a boneheaded dude, man.
Yeah, I know, right? But the whole experience has made him feel like himself again. He's back to the old Pumpkin King. I am the Pumpkin King. And I love that. That is Danny Elfman delivering that line, and I love it.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a great delivery because it's said with even more gusto than the original when we get that little riff in there, that one little melodic bit.
Yeah, I'm Jack. I am the Pumpkin King. And, you know, rips off the torn Sandy Claus suit. As you said, he has his regular Jack suit underneath.
Yeah, he didn't commit to the bit. That was just a quick costume that he threw over.
This is what I want to say. Santa's hat, completely intact. Christmas magic.
You know, it's got to put up with a lot of friction from high altitude air.
Not to mention the chimneys.
And soot from the chimneys.
So Santa's hat, completely intact. And Jack wants to set things right. Hopefully there's still time. And just jumps through a grave just to get... Apparently that's how you get to Halloween Town.
Yeah, any random grave. See, I told you, they're used to our world.
So, say what you want about Oogie. He took the time to sew Sally's hands and leg back to her body before tying her up.
Yeah, I mean, good for him, I guess. I don't know.
He didn't have to. He just, you know.
Yeah, he could have just lobbed bits of her into that pit.
Yeah. And like I said, Jack immediately runs to Oogie Boogie's. Like you said, Lock, Shock, and Barrel had him, so logically, go to Oogie's.
Yeah.
And, roll the dice, and Oogie's about to kill Sally and Santa, and when Jack gets in at the last minute and saves him.
Yeah, this is a really Bond villain sequence. Like, this is a way too complicated setup for this movie. I will remind you that it would be like 20 years before we got Saw, okay, in the Halloween genre there, okay? We were not used to complicated death traps in Halloween movies yet, so this is straight up Bond villain. This whole sequence.
Like, you're talking secretly swole, Jack was able to lift Santa Claus. And Sally.
Two secretly swole injuries. Yeah, you're right.
And this entire next sequence, the best way I can describe it, video game boss battle.
Yeah. Also, Jack turns into a spider. That kind of spidery move that he does around the roulette wheel or whatever as the kings are coming to life and trying to stab him is just beautifully animated and really unsettling. Because he's always been spindly, but he's always had very human movement. He'll do the occasional creepy thing, like take off his head or pull out his rib and throw it for the dog or whatever. But, like, he just straight up turns into a skittering spider bone thing.
Part of causing fear, maybe. So I guess using him to his advantage.
Yeah, so bravo for the animation on this, because it is excellent the way he moves.
Oogie may be good at sewing up Sally, but he's not very good at sewing himself. Loose threads. I've seen you sew some stuff together. Loose threads.
Yeah. you gotta sew in those ends, Boogie.
So loose thread gets caught, and Jack takes the opportunity and just rips off Oogie's sack body skin thing. And that whole image is kind of brilliant in the way it was animated. In how would I explain? There's a I'm trying to find the right way to describe it. It's like if you're by a mechanical tool and you try to touch it, it will literally rip the skin off your hand like a gloving. I think it's called.
Yeah,
that's
exactly
what happened to Oogie.
Yeah, it's creepy. Also, I like the reveal that Oogie is actually a gestalt creature. He is not one singular entity. He is literally a hive of bugs.
And worms. I think there's a few worms in there.
Yeah, various skittery creatures.
This actually was not the original plan for Oogie, because if you go into the extras on the Disney Plus version, there is actually the original idea of what Oogie was going to be. And it's straight out of The Wizard of Oz, because Oogie was supposed to be revealed to be Dr. Finkelstein.
Don't pay attention to the man behind the sackcloth?
Yep. And the reason is that in that one minute scene on the extras here, he pretty much says he created the character of Oogie Boogie to kill Jack so he can get Sally all to himself. Because he knew that Sally loved him.
In a way, I kind of think I would have liked that better if they'd have kept it. Because Oogie Boogie, despite the fact that you hear the children talk about him and Jack references him a couple of times, he is really superfluous to this movie, other than being the final hurdle Jack has to jump through. We know nothing about him, as previously stated. He has no real connection to the rest of Halloween Town. The gambling thing is strange and out of nowhere compared to the rest of the movie. We really don't see any of the other characters have strange vices or anything like that. Even the ones that probably should, because some of these other monsters definitely have in their lore. You know, they have their own quirks and vices and ways to beat them and stuff. But you gamble with the boogeyman for your freedom? Like, that's not really what I'm used to. I mean, there's things about gambling with death. And maybe that's where they got this idea, but it seems so out of the ordinary. And everything in Oogie Boogie's den is so kind of... Colorful, and New Orleans mixed with Vegas, and it's an entirely different world. So to suddenly have this be a character created by another character we already know, that we know would have a reasonable beef against Jack, and a clear motive for holding Sally hostage and, you know, wanting this to go wrong for Jack would have made a lot more sense than this kind of random bug in a bag character that we got.
Yep. I love that there's a, I guess you can call him the main bug, because he's still saying my bugs, as he skitter scatters, and gets squashed by Santa.
Is he the main one, or is he just the only one left? Because we hear all of the other ones saying it, too.
Yeah. Well, he's the only one that's a bright color, and they're all, like, regular bug color, you know, dark bug colors.
Yeah, okay, I can see that. Maybe that is the, like, you know, hive leader or whatever.
Maybe. So, Jack tries to apologize. Justifiably, Santa's ticked off. He's justifiably so. This guy sent people to kidnap me, tried to take over my holiday, and now you're just going to say you're sorry? You know? And I love that he just straight up says, Sally's the smartest person here. You should have listened to her. Like, she's the only one with any sense. Like, why don't you listen to her?
Yeah, I mean, and Santa Claus has been in a happy marriage for how many millennia? Come on.
Yeah.
Listen to the man.
And laying a finger aside of his nose with an anger and a frown, out of Oogie's he goes.
Yeah. The I did like that kind of subtle little nod to the poem that gave it the name there.
Yeah.
So, you know, the finger aside the nose, because that really is, at least in American culture, that is the only time, that poem is really the only time that that gets referenced, you know, is in relation to the poem.
So, but yeah, Santa, he can do it. He's Santa Claus. He can fix everything, because he's Santa Claus. I think that I like that. That's just his explanation. I'm Santa Claus. I can do anything.
Yeah, it's Santa. I'm Christmas. It's, you know, I'm Santa. It's Christmas.
Yeah.
I have powers nobody's ever been able to explain. You know, how does Santa visit the entire world in one night, even given that there's, you know, time zones and not everybody has a chimney, but he still gets in your house somehow. You know. Okay.
So this whole thing. Right after Santa leaves, Jack looks at Sally, like, and he realizes that Sally did all of this for him. The Santa Claus suit, the basket, the trying to rescue Santa Claus. Like, he did it all for him.
Trying to warn him that this was a ridiculous idea and maybe you don't want to do this because it's going to end badly with a missile to the face.
Yes. And it's a tender moment that gets ruined by the mayor being involved.
Yeah.
But, you know, Santa does fix everything, though. Because he's Santa Claus, because he can do that stuff. And was able, in record time, getting all the bad toys out and all the proper toys to the right kids, and one kid gets a dog.
that kid that goes from the shrunken head to the puppy. Is really the luckiest kid. Because as a kid, I was like, oh, I kind of would have liked some of Jack's gifts more than the, you know, whatever. But if it's a choice between anything and a puppy, I'm going with the puppy. So that one kid definitely got an upgrade in gift.
You have a puppy.
I do have a puppy. He's adorable.
So the finale, which is called The Finale. Again, Sebastian the Crab.
Darn you, Sebastian!
So everyone's happy. Jack's back, and you kind of get a little bit of a musical reprise of the This Is Halloween, with the, instead of singing the la la la, they're saying Jack is back. And Santa has one more gift to give, and that is snow to Halloween Town. Because, you know, it never snows on Halloween. Had to live through that this year.
Yeah. You poor little Midwesterners.
Yes. So it snows for the first time ever in Halloween Town. And obviously it's the first time these creatures have seen snow, because they have no idea what's going on. Despite having been in the human world. Very much like Jack, you know, they all singing, what's this? And I guess that's kind of, they kind of maybe they start understanding it because they start getting into more winter activities. You see characters making snow angels. Vampires are playing hockey. How do the vampires know how hockey works?
I don't know, but it's adorable.
And this is what I want to say, Tim Burton's cameo. If you go to the extras again on Disney Plus, you can see the original version of this hockey scene was supposed to feature the decapitated head of Tim Burton. And in the final film, they're using a jack-o'-lantern.
They should have kept the original in that one too.
Yeah, as far as cameos go, that would have probably been one of the best ones.
Yeah.
So we see the doctor's finally finished his creation, which looks like a female version of himself. That says a lot.
Yeah, again, yeah, very, very selfish, self-directed kind of man there.
Yeah. And, you know, while the citizens of Halloween Town are enjoying the first snowfall ever in the town, Sally is just wanders off, mostly because she probably saw Dr. Finkelstein and doesn't want to get locked up again.
Yeah.
But this time Jack follows her into the graveyard, into that spiral hill. And he kind of admits that he has a thing for her, too. You know, my dearest friend, I've come to join you. And, you know, they say that they are truly meant to be, and they have the kiss in the moonlight.
He's literally singing her song.
And it's like, and it's a beautiful ending to the movie, and Zero kind of flies off and doing the little star thing. But if you're going to have the ending to the movie, that's a nice little ending right there. Jack and Sally get together at the end. I don't know if it's Jack deserved to have the love at the end, but he gets the girl at the end.
Maybe that missile knocks some sense into him.
He finally realized that Sally was, you know, doing all this stuff for him in the first place, you know. There is an unused epilogue, and we talked about this earlier. When it was supposed to be, the narrator was supposed to be Patrick Stewart, assuming that he was also going to be playing Santa Claus, and we find out that the narrator is Santa Claus. Years later, in this unused epilogue, which is on the soundtrack, Santa goes back to Halloween Town. Jack looks exactly the same as he did before, but now him and Sally's got a couple of skeleton kids. Jack got busy. They don't call him Bone Daddy for nothing.
So, that was awful, and I hate you.
So, the rhyme says they have 4 or 5 children in hand, and they play weird songs in their xylophone band. So, not only does Jack have kids with Sally, but they're in a band.
I'm telling you, Disney guys just want bands.
So,
First Eric, now Jack.
And Santa asked Jack, if you could do it all over again, would you? And Jack looks at him and says, wouldn't you? And that's how the album ends. And presumably this was how it would have been the original ending of the movie. I prefer the ending of Jack and Sally on the Hill versus the epilogue. Though it's good to know that they did have a happy ending further along, that they stayed together for several years and have a family together. Don't know how that's going to work, considering she's like a ragdoll person, but the cartoon. So that's the Nightmare Before Christmas.
Woohoo!
So the question, does this movie hold up? Is it still good?
I think it's still good. I did enjoy it on the rewatch. However, I'm not certain that there's really a lot of plot there. Like I said, I think it's mostly aesthetic. Which is not bad. I mean, there is use for that in entertainment. Not everything has to be like super deep moral lesson or anything. But it's very thin, and I think it's mostly thin because it was meant to be a 30-minute Christmas special on TV, and they made it into a full-length movie.
Yeah. And to be fair, a lot of the older Disney movies were mostly episodic segments that just happened to play as a full story. And that's kind of what this is as well, in a way. And I still like the movie. I still consider the movie very good. I think it holds up. It really is a classic these days. You know, again, I enjoy myself watching this movie. There are people who devote their lives to this movie. There are, you know, how many people with that wear, you know, Nightmare Before Christmas merchandise today? There are people who've had characters from this movie tattooed on their body. There are people who really do love this movie, and justifiably so. Is there anything else that we can say about this movie? Go ahead.
I can't really think of too much. I am one of those people that likes the merchandise and I do like the aesthetic, and this is one of the only holiday movies I'm willing to watch on my own. I only watch two movies on Christmas typically, and they are Love Actually and Die Hard. Which I watch every Christmas Eve. I'm not really a Christmas person. I am, however, a huge Halloween person. So this kind of is the one thing that kind of bridges that for me. I didn't say anything to speak ill of this movie. It's just when I was rewatching it, I was like, oh, I thought I remembered there being a little more plot to this.
I think it's just the change from watching it as a kid to watching it as an adult.
Yeah.
But yeah, I still think one of the things, I'm surprised that there was never, like, a sequel made for this. And I think that really comes down to Tim Burton not wanting a sequel to this.
I think it would be very cheap and not great to do a sequel to this. I don't want a sequel to this. I am, however, surprised that Disney hasn't made a sequel to this because they make a sequel to everything. So, you know.
There is a kind of a sequel. There was a video game in 2004, I think it was, called Oogie's Revenge, which takes place 1 year after the movie takes place, which brings Lock, Shock, and Barrel resurrecting Oogie from whatever he, you know, from the dead, as it were. And Jack has gone off again, this time to find new ways to scare people to make next Halloween better. And Oogie takes over the town. It's you can find it on YouTube. And the great thing about it is a musical. The game is a musical. Characters sing, but it's all rewritten lyrics for the songs from the first movie. So, again, a column A, column B situation. Yeah, you're getting all the songs you like, but now they have the different lyrics that now address to this game storyline. It's an okay game, but, you know, not the sequel that you would expect from Disney, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, okay. I mean, they've done little bits of that with other things, where we were talking about how Ursula didn't get a song until a video game as well. I'm kind of glad they've left this one alone, as much as they have, because I don't really want it touched. It's kind of a perfect little bit of whatever it is.
Yeah, agreed. And again, that Disney has wholeheartedly embraced this movie in the, you know, almost 30 years since this movie came out. With, you know, you can meet Jack in the park, you can meet him, he's a big part of the Halloween parade. They changed the Haunted Mansion to be Nightmare Before Christmas every Halloween.
Yeah, which is great. And, you know, the Jack Skellington's character has become one of those cameos they put in all these Disney things.
Yeah.
And everything. There's a character that looks kind of like him in Princess and the Frog. He shows up in a lot of other, you know, Selick or Burton productions. He's definitely in Beetlejuice. He's definitely in Coraline. He's definitely in James and the Giant Peach, which he's actually just a character in James and the Giant Peach. They didn't even, you know, kind of do anything other than stick a pirate hat on him, but it's the same character, basically. He might be in Finding Nemo. There's debate on whether or not you can see his kind of silhouette. Things like that. So, I mean, he's shown up in a bunch of other stuff. Once Disney kind of embraced that this movie had fans, you know.
Yeah. So I think that's really all we can say about The Nightmare Before Christmas. Good movie. Yeah. Watch it. Definitely. We'll definitely watch it. So,
yeah, if you want something a little less schmaltzy for Christmas this year, show this one to your kids.
I always say to family, because especially recently, you know, Frozen 2 came out, and a lot of parents are aware of certain plot twists in this movie and don't want their little kids to be scarred for life. But so I always tell them, if your kid can handle The Nightmare Before Christmas, Frozen 2 will be nothing.
Yeah, and honestly, you know, spoiler alert, kids are way more resilient than you give them credit for. Just across the board. You gotta remember that, you know, all the things that these Disney movies are based on, you know, are come from really gruesome fairy tale stories that were meant for kids, you know? Kids love a good fright so long as it's in a safe space.
Yeah.
You know, so long as afterwards they can bury their head in your chest and be like, yay, you know? You know, I mean, maybe don't show this to your 2-year-old.
Yeah.
You know, but if you got, you know, an 8 or 9-year-old, you know, they're definitely old enough for this one, I'd say.
Yep, definitely. So let's move on to next week. Let's stay a little bit into the Christmas mood, but I'm going to spare you a full movie.
Yay!
I'm going to spare you a full movie.
It's an early Christmas gift.
Let's just do a short. Let's do a short. Let's do an extended short. Definitely one of my favorites. Mickey's Christmas Carol from 1983.
Ooh, definitely, going back in time a little.
Going back in time a little. Again, this is an era where you and I are very, very small.
Well, but also, when we got a little older, this was on TV every Christmas.
It is.
And I mean, it still is now. But I mean, there were, this was one of the prime, this was up there with Charlie Brown Christmas.
And this is a bit of a resurgence for Mickey, who kind of went away for a long time, not really being used much, if any, within the last 20 years or so at that point.
Yeah, there weren't a lot of Mickey shorts when we were little. Like, really little.
New ones, anyway. They were all the classic ones.
Yeah.
So this is like a return of Mickey Mouse in a way. So we're going to go back to that, the Christmas classic, Mickey's Christmas Carol. And we'll see where we go from there. Again, so next week might be a short one because this one's only 25 minutes long.
Yeah.
So that's about it. Again, all of you and yours have a very happy holiday season. And hopefully you guys will join us next week as we watch one more Christmas special.
Yeah. Thanks for joining us. It's been a blast.
Bye.
Bye. Thank you for listening to Rewatching the Magic. We invite you to keep the magic going by joining the conversation online. Find us on Facebook @RewatchingTheMagic, on Twitter @RewatchTheMagic, And of course, find all new episodes at rewatchingthemagic.podbean.com. Until next time, remember, the magic is for everyone. It only stops if you let it.